Good morning. 19 minutes away from 8 o'clock. It's Wednesday. I'm Bill Small. Joined in the studio and on the phone this morning by some of our friends from K-State. We've got Wendy Powell in the studio with us this morning. How are you, young lady?
I
probably turned your microphone on, the right one. There we go.
I'm great. How are you?
I think I'll be okay if I can just figure out all this nonsense here. And on the phone, we've got Jesse Gilmore. How are you doing, bud?
Pretty darn good. How are you doing?
It's just another day in paradise, my friend. So why don't we start with Wendy sharing some programs with us, and then we'll get to what you have, Jesse, so we don't have to... you don't have to get phone ear from being on there all morning long, and everybody will be happy that way.
All right, sounds good.
All right, Wendy, go ahead.
Okay, great. We have a huge list of programs coming up. You know, it's summertime, and so our 4-H agents are really busy. But we also have some programs, Fresh Conversations coming up, free cooking classes. Those are all taking place in Crawford County. Our pressure canner testing will be happening in each of the counties. That's going on through May 24th. So we've got flyers out with the different times and dates and the location. So Holly Meitner is doing those, and she'll be at each of the offices testing pressure canners. So if you're planning on doing any canning, be sure to get your tester, your canner tested. There we go.
There we go.
Powerful Tools for Caregivers, that's coming up in Parsons on May 3rd through June 7th. And that's a pre-evening program, 4 to 5:30, and it's a $5 cost. Pizza with Pedrera, the first one of those is happening today in Girard, and then we'll have on the 12th in Fredonia, the 25th in Independence, then 26th in Altamont. So this is an opportunity just to come have an informal conversation with our forage and crop livestock system specialist. So this Dr. Bruno Pedrera, he's a specialist in fertilizing pastures, crop fields, all the different things that go into that. So this is a great opportunity to just have some informal conversations. Serve Safe Food Handlers Training, May 12th. That's in Columbus. Age Wells Move 22, that's taking part in Franklin, Kansas on May 12th. Spring Crop Field Day coming up May 17th. That's next week, next Tuesday. And that'll be an excellent opportunity to go see what's going on out at the Parsons Research Station. Another Serve Safe Food Handlers Training on May 25th in Girard. Stay Strong, Stay Healthy. It's happening in Fredonia in May 31st through July. So that's a series. And our Tractor Safety Program is coming up June 2nd and 3rd in Parsons. So anybody interested in that needs to call any of the extension offices, and we can get you signed up for that. Kitchen Kids Camp, Kids Sewing Maker Camp, and another a couple more offerings of the Kitchen Kids Camp. Those are happening all across the district throughout the month of June. So lots of opportunity for kids to get involved in sewing, making crafts and other projects, and then also cooking. So it'll be a great opportunity. Grant Writing Virtual Workshop on June 28th and 30th as well. So check out our events on the Wildcat District webpage. We've got tons of stuff coming up.
Okay. And Jesse, what do you got for us today?
Today I'm going to be talking a little bit about utility safety and how that applies to landscapes and trees. Last week I had the opportunity to attend a power line safety training by Evergy in the Parsons area and learned a lot about power lines and kind of the way they work. Saw some very, not disturbing isn't quite the right word, but unsettling is probably the best word for it, video of people getting electrocuted by power lines because they didn't really have a high level of respect for electricity and how destructive it can be if it's not being approached in the right way.
Very shocking.
In my realm, oh, sorry, go ahead.
That's a very shocking.
Yes. Oh my gosh.
They pay me to make little comments like that, Jesse. I just warn you right now. They actually pay me really well to make funny little comments like that.
Yep, they sure do. In my realm, most of the time when you're dealing with power lines above, it's going to be in the realm of trees. And I know quite a few people who are not very happy with the power companies when they come in and clear the lines of any tree limbs that might be nearby. And you can find some really, really interesting pictures of the trees and how they just carve out a safety net area around the line. And, you know, power companies get a lot of flack for that, but it's not their job to keep the trees looking nice. It's their job to keep the power lines up and transmitting power continuously. And what I said when I was at the workshop is, if you have to cut a tree back, either the tree is in the wrong place or it's the wrong tree.
Mm-hmm.
So looking up and considering the full height of the tree once it becomes mature is a very important thing to do when choosing and planting trees. You definitely want to give power lines a wide berth, and if you're thinking about putting something immediately under power lines, consider choosing a more ornamental tree than a shade tree, or choose a smaller variety of a shade tree that will stay smaller and more compact. That way you're not getting limbs that could be encroaching on the power lines and might cause a power outage or a downed line if for some reason those limbs would fall on the line. If you are doing work in trees, as far as pruning goes, this could be the homeowner, this could be the tree service. Usually you will be able to call power companies before pruning trees that are close to power lines. I know that Evergy, which is the Kansas electrical company, it might be different in other states in the listening area, they will come out and put line covers on your line to ensure that you are staying safe while pruning. Wood, people will often talk about wood as not being a conductor of electricity, but they did some demos of power lines. They have power lines that are hooked up to a portable generator that they wheel around to different demonstrations that they do. And those wires are live with the current that they would have up on the power line poles. They put tree branches across two different lines, and they caught on fire with the electrical potential that flowed through it. So even though wood is not a great conductor of electricity, it will still conduct enough electricity to seriously injure or potentially even kill you if it is across multiple different potentials.
Yeah, let's not take any chances with it. I was saying, let's not take any chances with that. Electricity is electricity, and even though, like you said, wood is not a great conductor, it conducts enough.
Yep, and a lot of times those things that aren't good conductors, they will still conduct electricity because of contaminants. So if you accidentally touch a electrical line with a wood shovel pole, for example, the oils from your hands or any dirt that might get on the wood is actually what conducts the electricity. Water is itself a perfect insulator if it does not have any contaminants in it. It's the contaminants in water that end up conducting electricity through it. And you can't really control what contaminants are on your tools that you're using. So it is always a good idea to maintain a safe distance from power lines. One other interesting thing I learned about electricity and power lines is that even if you're not physically touching the power line, if you're getting close enough to the power line with a conducting material, you can still get what's known as induced voltage. So the electrical lines will put out a moderate field, and it varies in distance depending on the current that's going through it. Obviously, three-phase electrical lines are going to have more current running through it, and so they can transmit electricity farther through the air. But it's a process known as induced voltage, where electricity can jump from the power line to anything nearby it. And usually it's not going to be more than 15 feet, but there was a story they told about a John Deere dealership that was right underneath this really common three-phase power line, which is just three lines running in parallel with each other down across the coast. And every day, the workers would come out to their machines, and they would, you know, start working on their machines, showing them off to the customers. And every time the dealer or one of the employees would touch their machine, they would end up getting shocked. And not enough to cause serious injury, but it was, you know, you don't want to get shocked.
No.
It was causing problems. And what they found out is because they were, the machines were right under the power lines, that voltage was jumping into the machines and making its way into the ground via their tractors and their combines. And so they had to move their machines out from immediately under the power line. That's kind of what to keep in mind as far as above ground power lines go. There are some things you can do to be safe while digging. Obviously, most plants are going to need some type of soil or hole to go into if you're creating a landscape around your property. There's about 20 million miles of underground utilities buried in the U.S., and on average, an underground utility is damaged every 6 minutes. And so back in 2005, the FCC, every state, has a number that you can call for your utilities to get marked. And it used to be a different 800 number for every state, but in 2005, the FCC shortened it to 811.
Right.
And so you can call 811 before you dig, and they will come out and mark all of the utilities on your property so that you're not hitting an electrical line, a gas line, sewage, anything like that.
You mess up the whole neighborhood that way.
Yep. Each state is going to have a different amount of time that your markings will be good for. In the four states in the listening area, you have to call at least 2 working days before you are going to dig. And the markings will be good for a different amount of time. In Kansas, Kansas is the simplest. The markings are good for 15 days. In Missouri, the markings are going to be good as long as they are visible. In Oklahoma, the markings are good for either 10 business days or until they become not visible anymore, whichever is shorter. And in Arkansas, it's good for up to 20 working days if the work is started within 10 days and the markings are still visible. So Arkansas definitely has the most complicated laws for that. But in general, your markings are going to be visible for a while unless we get like a severe rainfall like that one day where we had 7 inches of rain.
Yes, when the sky opened up and drowned us all. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. And it's always a good idea to have those marked just so you're not potentially hitting anything. They did talk about some underground electrical damage at the workshop that I went to where this guy hit a line underground right next to an electrical box that he thought was an irrigation line. It jumped out of the hole and basically up into his face because the electricity had nowhere else to go. He got severe burns on his face, electrical burns on his face. So underground electrical lines can also be a serious problem if you are hitting them. When you have your utilities marked, the markings will be color-coded based on what type of line you've got. It should be the standard, but it can vary from utility company to utility company. The flags that they put in the ground where the lines are marked have exactly what line is underneath, but the standard is typically red for electrical, orange for telecoms, being cable and internet. Those are the ones you really don't want to hit because then your neighbors get super mad at you.
Yeah, and they know where you live.
Don't cut people off from their internet or their cable.
No, please don't.
People get very, very mad about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yellow is for gas or oil, green is for sewage, and blue is for drinking water. And the final thing to keep in mind about marked utilities is just because there are no markings where you're going to dig doesn't mean there aren't things you can hit, like sewage or septic systems, irrigation systems, or other things that could be buried underground. You just want to make sure that you dig carefully and look around you to inspect what could be getting in your way. It could be plant roots, could be rocks, could be other things that they don't necessarily mark. So you always want to play it safe and do what you can to make sure you know what you're digging around before you start.
Okay, we got about 30 seconds before we got a break. Are you going to hang with us for the second segment as well? I know Wendy's got... Go ahead.
Unfortunately not. I've got to take off and do a tomato class this morning.
Oh,
but,
man,
all
right.
I'll be talking about tomatoes next time I will be on the radio.
All right, we'll look forward to chatting with you then, Jesse Gilmore, K-State. And then when we come back after the news at the top of the hour, we'll visit with Wendy Powell about the topic that I've already forgotten. I'm sorry?
Pasture fertilization.
All right, that's all coming up this morning. Stick with us on KGGF. About 12 and a half minutes after 8 o'clock on a Wednesday morning. Like you heard the man say, mostly sunny, 88 today. Down to 68 tonight under clear skies. And then sunny and 89 tomorrow. Right now, 74 degrees in beautiful downtown Coffeyville. I'm Bill Small, joined by Wendy Powell here from the our friends at K-State. And, you know, I look at pastures as I'm driving by, and I think, these things, don't they just, like, take care of themselves? You're here to tell us that pastures need fertilizing.
Yes.
I didn't. I was today years old when I knew that.
All right. Well, it is a common misconception that native pastures don't need fertilizer.
Mm-hmm.
And I will qualify that with native pastures that have always been taken care of properly. And I will say that that is very few native pastures that have never been overgrazed. They've always been burned properly. So if you have one of those virgin native pastures that's always been stocked at the correct stocking rate and it's been burned regularly, maybe not every year, but every few years, then yeah, you probably don't need to fertilize your pasture, but I would still encourage you to go ahead and pull some soil samples.
Okay, that's how you can tell whether or not you need to add some fertilizer.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So a soil sample is $10.
Uh-huh.
$10. And if anybody's been checking on fertilizer prices regularly here lately, it's been triple what it usually is. So a ton of urea might be $900, whereas in the past, a ton might be running $300 or $400.
What's the reason for the price hike?
Well, that is a great question that I am not expert enough to know the answer, but I can say that the Russian-Ukraine conflict has a little to do with that.
Yeah.
There's been some transportation issues across
supply chain and all that.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So with that being said, supply chain issues will continue in the future because this year, obviously, we're having problems getting all of our fertilizer needs met, and next year we'll probably have the same because, you know, supply and demand, when demand goes up, supply goes down,
right.
So prices are going to remain high. So there are a few things that we can do to mitigate that cost and make for sure that our pastures stay productive for the next few years.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one I've already alluded to, soil testing. So if you've got pastures that have different management areas, and a management area is going to be like, you've got so many acres in a pasture, but a creek runs through the middle of it. And so maybe the cows spend a little less time on the backside of the creek and, you know, they're managed a little differently. They've been sprayed differently, herbicide or prescribed burn a little differently. Those are different management areas.
Okay.
So you'll want to soil sample those separately. And super simple to soil sample. Say that 12 times fast.
Super simple to soil sample.
Each one of
I'm
our
a professional. Don't try this at home. You could hurt yourself.
There you go. So each one of our offices have soil probes that folks can borrow to go out and soil sample their pasture. And it's real easy to do that. So I'm happy to visit with folks. Just make sure you're using those management areas. I've talked to a lot of people this year about establishing legumes, so clover, common lespediza, Korean lespediza, alfalfa even, just some different legumes to get nitrogen back into the soil. And that is an excellent way to help mitigate fertilizer prices.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to caution folks that you're not going to see results of that for 2 or 3 years.
Right.
that nitrogen isn't released by the plant until the plant is decaying.
Right.
So each year, of course, there's going to be new plants come on and old plants decaying. So if you're establishing it in 2022, you're probably not going to have any decay until, well, we hope. 23 or 24. So getting that process started is great. But the folks that are reaping the benefit of those legume establishments in high fertilizer price time right now are the ones that they started on this process 4 or 5 years ago.
Okay.
If you're going to go ahead and start legumes, that's great. The price of seed has exponentially increased along with the
everything
price of fertilizer.
Else. Yeah.
Yes. And so I still want you to get a soil test done. The pH, especially on nearly all clovers, is those clover seeds are really sensitive to pH levels. And lime is actually not that expensive these days. It has not increased the way urea, DAP, potash, all of those have increased. So get a soil sample, establish apply some lime if you need to, and then address the clover establishment.
Now, the lime will bring down the acidity or hike the acidity?
It'll increase it. So if you're, most of the time around here in southeast Kansas, our pH levels are too low.
Ah.
If your pH level is too high, there are some ways we can mitigate that. It's still a long-term plan, but that's pretty uncommon. So make for sure that you're getting a soil test and addressing that pH.
Okay.
Some research that I did as an agent in Oklahoma, we fertilized some Bermuda pasture at different rates, and we discovered that it might be more economical to fertilize a small area at the recommended rate versus trying to spread our dollars out over the entire pasture.
Mm-hmm.
So let's take 100 acres and we need 100 pounds. This is for Wendy's easy math in her head. So we've got a limited budget. We can only spend X number of dollars on fertilizer. So we're going to spread all of that fertilizer over all of the pasture, but it's only going to be at half of the recommended rate.
Okay.
So we're going to have we're not going to reach our optimum production throughout the whole pasture. So if you were to take that 100 acres and let's say 25 of those 100 acres, you are applying the recommended rate. So pouring a lot of dollars into a quarter of the pasture, but you can graze that properly or at your usual stocking rate because it's going to reach its optimum production. Now, the rest of your pasture, the other 75 acres, yeah, that's going to suffer a little bit. So you'll need to adjust your stocking rate. But this is a strategy to consider whenever you have super high value hay fields or you're doing some summer annuals and you're trying to get that hay production or grazing days throughout the growing season. So consider that, yeah, fertilizing smaller areas might be more economical than trying to do the whole place at a half rate. Or
yeah, it kind of makes sense to think of it that way.
Yeah, yeah, sure. So it's kind of like whenever you're taking your prescription, you have, you know, two pills left, so you're going to cut them in half so you have them for 4 days rather
than... But they're
not
going to work as well.
Exactly.
Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. The other thing to consider whenever we're talking about this, and usually this is something we talk about more in drought years, and you know, this week we're not in a drought.
Yeah, we seem to have solved that problem.
Yes, but we never know what the weather is going to do for the rest of the season.
We didn't want it all at once, but
exactly. Yeah, we fertilized some plots earlier this week, and we need a half an inch of rain on those areas and no more.
Right.
But I don't know that that's going to be provided.
We'll put the order in and see what happens.
Thank you. It's probably going to get back ordered.
Still, you know, supply chain issues with the rain, too, I guess.
Yes. So stocking rates need to be considered. So making for sure that the livestock that you're putting on those pastures is not going to completely deplete the supply of forage.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say deplete the supply, I don't mean just the leaf tissue that's above ground. We have to consider that the root production below ground only happens when the leaf tissue is collecting sunlight and rain above ground.
Mm-hmm. Photosynthesis and all that.
Yes.
Stuff I learned in school.
That's right. Yeah, one of those big $10 words,
yeah,
photosynthesis.
Really. I bring it up every now and then just to make myself appear intelligent.
There you go. So if that leaf tissue is not above ground, then those roots are not able to store carbohydrates or do their job below ground.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to make for sure that we're leaving enough, we call it residue height in pastures. We leave enough residue height in the plant, in the pasture, to take care of our roots so that we have a pasture next season to graze to. So it, we have to think about a long-term game plan with our pasture management. And if we don't, we're going to – I've seen some pastures that just make me very sad.
Makes you want to cry.
Yeah. They look like golf courses out there with some cedar trees in them.
Mm-hmm.
And really, we need to be very cognizant of what the long-term plan is.
Right.
And we get into situations like pasture rentals and short-term rental agreements. And so it's profitable for a livestock owner to heavy stock a pasture that they may or may not have next year, so they get all of the grass available, versus if they knew that that pasture is available to them for 5 years, they're more likely to take care of it and maybe not overgraze it quite as much. So that's something to consider whenever we're turning stock out to summer pasture and making for sure that we're being good caretakers of the land.
And so one thing we've learned today is that these areas, these pieces of ground do not necessarily take care of themselves. They need proper stewardship, and that's what you're here to talk about.
That's right. So the other strategy that I've heard here lately is I'm not going to fertilize, I'm just going to put down some weed control. Okay, well, that's a legitimate strategy. Whenever you are applying your herbicides, just make for sure that you have a great identification of your plant and read the herbicide label.
Right.
There are a lot, ragweed, for instance, a lot of weeds that 2,4-D will kill. 2,4-D is usually a really economically easy to buy
right.
product. So it's great to put out there on a pasture. However, weeds grow pretty fast.
Yeah, they do.
And
that's why they say it grows like a weed.
That's right. And 2,4-D will only work on ragweed when it's small. So whenever it gets to be 4 or 6 inches, 2,4-D is just, you know, rain
mm-hmm.
on that plant. And it's not going to do any killing.
Yeah, the,
of the
plant is laughing at it at that point.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes.
What do you think you're doing here?
So then you're wasting your time applying it. You've wasted your dollars on herbicide. Even if it's not a lot of dollars, still it's some that
mm-hmm.
You might consider using a more powerful herbicide. So making for sure that you have the correct identification of the plant. And that's something that I'm happy to help folks with. And then making for sure that you're applying the correct herbicide at the correct time.
Okay. Is there a website folks can go to sort of get this information in one place?
So there's tons of different resources. It kind of depends on what we're looking for. If we're mm-hmm. looking for fertilizer information, K-State has some forage fact sheets. Say that 12 times.
Forest
fast.
Fact. Okay.
I win.
Forage fact sheets.
There you go. So we've got those, and they're all linked on our K-State webpage. But if you're looking for something specific, folks can give me a call, and I'd be happy to help direct them or shoot me an email. My phone number is 620. Uh-huh.
You never call yourself. You know, ask me what my phone number is. I'll have to look at it.
Here we go. 620-784-5337.
That's Are you sure?
I'm going to say that with confidence.
Okay.
620-784-5337. That's the Altamont office. And then folks can also shoot me an email, and that's Wendy, Wendie, Powell, P as in Paul, Owell, at ksu.edu. So I can come out and take a look at your pasture, help you with some weed ID if you want, and we can talk about different strategies for management.
All right. Well, thank you for spending some time with us this morning, getting us all edumacated on fertilizing the pastures and making sure everything's all hunky-dory so we're not wearing out the ground any more than it has to be. Wendy Powell from K-State right here on the Mighty 690 KGGF.